we Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, Coordinator for Stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship, lcms.org/stewardship.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're broadcasting from the Finding Our Voice Conference at St. Louis University. Our guest for the final half hour of the program, Dr. Alvin Schmidt. We're going to be talking about the concept and the practice of sexual fidelity in a pagan culture, getting a bit of a historical perspective on that. It's certainly not only the reality that Christians find themselves in today, living in the Western world in an increasingly secular and paganized society, but it is kind of the ordinary situation for Christians throughout history. We'll be talking about that. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College, author of the book, How Christianity Changed the World. He joins us to talk about sexual fidelity in a pagan culture. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Thank you.
Give us a little bit of perspective here. Is it true, generally speaking, that there's a parallel between what Christians find themselves in societally today and where Christians found themselves in the same respect in the first century?
Yeah, very much so. And the parallel has become more pronounced within the last few years. The early Christians, when they came from the Middle East to the Roman area, often not just in the city of Rome, but the areas typically widely called Rome, there's an old saying, when you're in Rome, do as the Romans do. Well, the early Christians, when they came to Rome, did not do as the Romans did, morally speaking, and many other ways, for example. And it's one of the things I will be starting off with today, for example. The decadence, sexual immorality, appalled them. And a number of other things appalled them, for example. the Romans were given to enjoying games where men died fighting beasts. They had the gladiatorial contests where individuals got killed, were trained to be physically fit before this event happened. In addition to that, they mimed sex on the stage of the theater. In addition to that, for example, they practiced abortion, infanticide, killing babies, as well as abandoning babies. The Christians would have nothing to do with that. Divorce was widespread. Marriage had become basically an eyesight. Some of the pagan authors of that era had become a laughing stock. And in addition to that, as you also know, they encountered cremation, which they resisted. All of those factors were immoral to the Christians. And as a result of that, they were persecuted intensely for basically 300 years because they didn't conform. And nevertheless, as I cite, for example, additional literature outside the New Testament, like the Didache, which is a short church manual that's been found only in 1871. It's published about 100 A.D. So it's one of the oldest documents outside of the New Testament. And again, the Didache is very clear that Christians, it spells out, not to spell, practice adultery, abortion, pederasty, which is pedophilia as we call it, homosexuality. Then a little bit later in the second century, you have, for example, another document that was written by the Christians, namely the Epistle of Barnabas. And again, some of those same immoralities are spelled out for Christians not to participate in. And then still, at the latter part of the second century, you have another epistle called the Epistle of Diognetus. And again, once more spelled out. And it's interesting, about 20th, when Emperor Hadrian was a emperor of the Roman Empire. Individuals, there was a Christian philosopher by the name of Aristides from Athens, who defended Christianity in his presence or to his assistant, which also by the name, by the way, was called Diognetus. And he indicated, for example, that the Christians share a common table, but they don't share a common bed. Again, emphasizing their morality, sexually speaking. And Libanius, a Roman individual in the second century, also said, what women these Christians have. In other words, they stood out apart from the Roman Empire or the Romans, the pagans, morally speaking, whether it was sexually or other kinds of behavior. And so they very much made their mark. Now, today, the question to ask, you ask a little while, we have basically revived the Roman immorality with the exception of one particular sin that the Christians oppose that still, oddly enough, in our society is outlawed, pedophilia, called pederasty in those days. That's the only law that's still on the in our books. The others have all been removed, and in that sense, we've gone back to the pagan Romans, morally speaking.
Well, I guess since we're in that vein, given the, and you have a longer perspective on this, having studied these things as a sociologist for years, but given the direction, at least the apparent direction of both culture and law in the United States and a lot of Western Europe, do you think we're far from eliminating the prohibitions against pederasty and the variations there and being fully Roman?
That's an excellent question. Yes, we have already moved in that direction in the West in more countries than one. For example, let me cite a couple of illustrations. Back in the late 1990s, I happened to be in London, England at the time, and saw the demonstrators in front of the Parliament in London. The Parliament was considering of reducing the age of male homosexual involvement from 21 to 18, which they did pass. But in the meantime, crowds around the street demanding it should be lowered to 16. But let's not stop there. In most European countries, it's already been lowered to 14 years of age. It's a true, likewise in Canada. So in a sense, the pedophilia laws are already significantly toned down, if I may use that word. And then you have in our country, it's also in Canada, hence the name North American Man-Boy Love Association. It has a million members. Well, 10 years ago, it might be a more than a million members. Its major goal is to remove the pedophilia laws in our society, to bring about man-boy love association participation, as the Romans had it. It was perfectly legal and common among the Romans. And so we're not that far away. When will it happen? I don't know. But we're already moved a great deal to it, as I said, by lowering the age for boys and adult male to participate in sex to 14.
And you mentioned that it was not just legal, but it was in some cases, especially among the nobility and the aristocracy, it was almost an expectation for men of standing, of wealth, of leisure, to have this kind of very stratified sexual practice. They certainly kept wives, perhaps mistresses, but also young boys.
Oh, yeah, very common. And it was all the way down from the emperors to the person on the street. Yes, it was very common. And it didn't raise any eyebrows. Sexual immorality was so widespread that the Romans... Well, let me... A few years ago, a very interesting book was published by a fellow by the name of John Clark. It's called Lovemaking and in the Roman Society from 50 BC to 150 AD, if I remember correctly the dates. And he portrays what has been found in archaeology, graphic pictures that were found on household vases, pottery, frescoes, men and women heterosexually cohabiting. In addition to that, with men and boys all on a vase in the household, mm-hmm. or two men with two women, or two men and one woman. All of these were portrayed, and the children, the Romans, pagans, grew up with those pictures. And by the time they became of puberty age, they had internalized this behavior, and hence they behaved as the way they did.
So it's safe to say, we got about a minute and a half before we take a break, it's safe to say that when the early Christians entered into the public square in society, they had to stand out like a sore thumb. If they occupied any position in Roman society, they had to stand out and be very noticeable.
That's right, and that's why they were persecuted for 300 years, and sometimes intensely so. There were basically 10 major waves of persecution from the time the Christians came to Rome, which was back in around in the 60s A.D. And, you know, Paul lost his head, Peter was executed, all in the 60s, and it continued to go. And then he had a very severe persecution in the 90s under Emperor Domitian, and then sometimes there was a lapse, and it didn't always take place in the same parts of Rome. It spread out over the Roman Empire all the way into the Mediterranean area. And then, for example, you had the most intense persecution that came right around the end of the 200s, actually in 305 under Emperor Diocletian, where, for example, churches were destroyed, Bibles were destroyed, and Christians were executed, and those who didn't obviously had to, they had a choice to worship the emperor or make some kind of sacrifice. If not, they were either imprisoned or tortured or executed, all because they didn't conform to Romans' values.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. He is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College and author of the book, How Christianity Changed the World. We're talking about sexual fidelity in a pagan culture, past and present. And we are broadcasting from the Finding Our Voice Conference at St. Louis University on this Wednesday afternoon, August the 12th. When we come back, we're going to talk about the concept among the early Christians of sexual fidelity. It certainly is the picture that is painted in the New Testament for us when Paul warns against sexual immorality and then positively regards the marriage bed and sexual fidelity. We'll talk about that after this.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and lay people worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy promotes confessional Lutheran theology through conferences, scholarly exchanges, and publications like Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic Series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up for their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. lutheracademy.com.
Hey, St. Louis. How would you like to achieve your fitness goals in a fun and supportive atmosphere? Hi, this is Kevin Reisick, owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. We offer adult boot camps throughout the week. These camps include cardiovascular conditioning, muscular strength and endurance training, balance and coordination activities, and more. For more information, give me a call at 618-670-6952, Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois, 618-670-6952.
Your lifeline to the Lutheran worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. St. John Lutheran, Springfield, Pennsylvania. Zion Lutheran, Detroit, Michigan. St. Paul's Lutheran, Long Beach, California. All Saints Lutheran, Charlotte, North Carolina. Redeemer Lutheran, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Shepherd of the Lake Lutheran, Garrison, Minnesota, Emmanuel Lutheran, Kansas City, Missouri, and Holy Cross Lutheran, St. Genevieve, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. Journal, issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Wednesday afternoon, we're broadcasting from the Finding Our Voice Conference at St. Louis University. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. Dr. Schmidt, what was the concept? How would you describe the concept among the earliest Christians, even from the apostolic time, of sexual fidelity? How did they view this, especially over against the pagan culture they lived in?
Well, yes, good question. You see a great deal of it portrayed by Paul's writing relative to what he wrote to the Corinthian Christians, as well as, for example, he mentioned briefly to the Thessalonian Christians, but most intensely, perhaps, in the first chapter of Romans, where he specifically addresses the issue of the sin of homosexuality. Paul, for example, had founded the Corinthian congregation about 51 A.D., and he'd been there for 18 months where he was teaching and preaching. Then he went back to Ephesus and spent quite a bit of time there. But only 4 years later, in about A.D. 55, massive reversal happened in the congregation of Corinth, where people again began to pick up their Roman sexual practices. And Paul addresses that very, very much, for example, in 1 Corinthians 6, where he speaks about the sins of porneia, which is a Greek word from which we get the word pornography. And porneia was a very powerful kind of sexual deviant behavior. It didn't just refer to one particular sexual deviancy. Most commonly in recent years, it's been translated as sexual immorality. Older translations often translated as fornication, which is really not that well. Sexual immorality is good because it's much broader. And the sin of porneia, which Paul specifically mentions in Corinth, he mentions in Thessalonica. And, for example, then when he talks about in 1 Romans, he addresses the homosexuality problem. Again, the term porneia also comes part of the context. And so when the Christians in Corinth reverted to the sexual behavior that they basically grew up with, Paul, of course, drew some very strict strictures in terms. In fact, he even mentioned in one case, for example, a man was living with his mother sexually. And so he mentions excommunicate them, if I may use that word.
And his concern there is that was not only taking place, but that the Corinthian congregation was essentially turning a blind eye to it, or even offering tacit approval
right.
of that relationship.
Right. And you know, and to Paul, again, to pick up on the word porneia, apparently, as best as I can determine, the word porneia to him meant it was, as I indicated, a broad spread, wide sexual deviant behavior. But it also indicated to him that people who engaged in this did not just harm themselves physically, but the body of Christ as well. It was harmed because Paul, in that context, then speaks, you as Christians were the temple of the Holy Spirit. And for example, now you are violating that temple by the way you behave sexually or misbehave.
So he not only issues a picture, or he not only condemns these things that are being practiced or permitted in various early Christian congregations, these pagan practices, but he also has a positive picture of human sexuality or sexual fidelity for those congregations as well. How would you describe that?
Yeah, for example, now Paul didn't write Hebrews, but find in the book of Hebrews, for example, it says the marriage bed is undefiled. And as I indicated before, even the pagans recognize the Christians share a common meal, but they don't share their wives or common bed. And so this is what Paul was advocating, for example, that they should live a upright sexual life as Christians. And he took his patterns largely from the Old Testament. In the beginning, God made man and woman. They were supposed to be faithful to each other. And we see this, for example, also in the Gospels by Jesus, for example, where it clearly indicates that adultery was a behavior not permitted by Christians. And so the Christians set a new standard. And I might mention one other thing. It's very interesting, by the 4th century, shortly after the Council of Nicaea, which happened in 325, by this time you already had a Christian emperor at the helm, namely Constantine the Great, as he's often called. He became a Christian in the year 12, the same year he conquered a Roman usurper, Maxentius, for example, and became the sole emperor of the empire. And very soon he began to implement morality from a Christian perspective. This is very fascinating at all. In fact, one of the first things he did was to penalize the pagan priests for their homosexual behavior. And then a little bit later, his sons, Constantinus II and Constance, in the 360s, outlawed homosexual behavior. And then still another 30 years later, you had Theodosius I, the emperor, outlaw again homosexual behavior with the penalty provided for sentence of burning them. And then after this, slowly the Western society continued to pick up. And by the time of 11th century, all of Western society had implemented basically Christian values relative to sexual behavior. And they stayed there until the last decade or two.
So what kind of lessons does that give us today in the 21st century, where, as you mentioned earlier, we find ourselves in many ways paralleling as a culture Roman society and coming very close to approaching a one-for-one match with the sexual mores of the Roman society? How would you speak to that?
Well, we have in some ways even gone farther than the Romans did. The Romans didn't speak about homosexuals being married. We today are. That is a new one. They for some reason or another, didn't consider them legally married as such. I can't find any evidence for that. So in that sense, we have gone even farther. But other than that, we have basically, as we mentioned a little while ago, kept pedophilia still illegal. And, you know, there's a saying in history, the best predictor of the future is the past. And if we take that, we can say, and I would venture to guess, it won't be long that our pedophilia laws will be called Christian, the Christian influence, therefore we need to remove them, and that they're discriminatory and no longer provide equality.
So in other words, you're supposing something beyond what most people will note about this. Most people will note that the society might go its own way, irrespective of any Christian morality still embedded in society. You're saying that American society has a tendency to react against Christian morality that may still be embedded in our laws.
And so does Western Europe, for example. There's really no difference anymore. Most European countries, I think it's 23 countries at the moment that have legalized homosexual marriage. And most of them are, of course, in Europe. So in that sense, there isn't a great deal of difference between the United States and us anymore. And if you had another comment at the end, and I lost your train of thought.
Well, there. Just that they react against Christian morality that's still embedded in our laws and society.
Yes, Christianity today is obviously persecuted again in a different way, and in persecution that is now already present. For example, it's taking place in our military. Chaplains cannot have lost certain rights. There is even an effort now to select recruitment in the military that, if you can find non-Christians, take them. So it's already beginning to surface. And I might argue as well that in terms of Christianity being, frowned upon and discriminated again, is becoming common. And the tragedy of it is that most Christians today are beginning to buy into this change. We, on only July the 2nd, the Pew Research did, and it found that almost two-thirds, 60-some% of Christians in this country saw no conflict between homosexuality and their Christian beliefs. A little earlier than that, in the Republic of Rome, of Ireland, dominantly Catholic, 62% voted for homosexual marriages. So you can see, for example, that Christians are not only being persecuted again, but they're capitulating to the pagan Roman morality that the early Christians so strongly fought against.
With only 1 minute here, then, before we wrap up our conversation, what was the result in Roman culture of that kind of sexual morality, and how does that bode for Western society today? You got about a minute, Dr. Schmidt.
Well, they were very much, for example, basic institutions had lost their respect. Marriage was one of them. And I quote, for example, I'll cite a couple of references in my upcoming paper this afternoon, how that had deteriorated and it had become a laughingstock on society. It was basically seen as a necessary evil, but not anything with blessings or desirable kind of an institution that you want to have. Already before Christ was born, Caesar, for example, had implemented a law called adulterous against adultery, but it was not successful because only the woman was published in adultery, never the man. And so it didn't succeed. In other words, he was trying to preserve marriage, but it failed. And so, well, we have in our society too, let's be honest, marriage is not a very successful proposition today. Even among Christians, there's little or no difference between Christians getting divorces and those who are not. In other words, in that sense, again, we have taken over the Roman behavior.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He's author of the book, How Christianity Changed the World. You can find a link to it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Schmidt, thank you very much for being our guest.
My thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to have Dr. Andrew Steinman answer the question, does Ecclesiastes 6, verses 3 through 5, support abortion rights? And we'll talk with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer about Christ in Proverbs chapter 9. We can learn from history, even ancient history, and Christianity probably saw it coming when it was the Roman society. There was a collapse of Roman society. It fell apart. It rotted from within. And the same fate awaits us here in the Western civilization if we do not take heed. I'm Todd Wilkin. Goodbye from Finding Our Voice Conference in St. Louis. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Do you have a hard time finding Christian greeting cards and gifts that aren't either sappy or theologically suspect? Ad Crucem offers the perfect combination of art and the truth of the Scriptures with beautiful and reverent greeting cards and gifts. Deliver the true comfort of the gospel, Christ crucified for sinners, to family and friends with Ad Crucem. ADCRUCEM.com. Confessing the faith through art and word. AdCrucem.com.
Repentance and forgiveness, sin and grace, law and gospel. More than cliches, real preaching for real people in need of hearing the real Christ. Christ for you and the divine service at St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, Illinois, where we gather every Saturday night at 6 and on the Lord's Day, Sunday mornings at 7:45 and 10. Look for the Church of the Neon Cross on I-55 between exits 30 and 33. Find us on the web, stpaullutheranchurchhamel.org. St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, where there is the forgiveness of sins, life and salvation for the people of God.